The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Anyway, I'm going to be using from Bodhidharma his discourse on pure meditation that he did of question and answers with his disciple, you know, and kind of in that Reverend Huber translated in Buddhist writings, which was nicely the one thing that Reverend Master Jiyu had asked Reverend Huber to translate out of Bodhidharma's writings. So I thought, it's good that I'm going to talk on that, since obviously that was what she thought was the most a very helpful teaching. It's fairly lengthy, at least in terms of going through it, obviously, since there's, you know, 435 pages of writing, but the beginning really gets the essence of it, and I'll jump around a bit and kind of just try to cover a few of the main points in the next two lectures. But it begins with Bodhidharma's disciple, Wiko Taisoeka, asked, when people are committed to seeking the Buddhist ways, what methods of training should they consider? Bodhidharma replied, since pure meditation embraces all methods and practice, I call it the essential one. Taisoeka, how can one single method embrace all practices? Bodhidharma replies, pure meditation is the root and source of all methods. All methods are simply the product of our small mind. So if you are able to thoroughly comprehend what your mind really is, then all your practices will be fully equipped with what they need to be successful. An analogy, consider a great tree. Its branches, blossoms, and fruit all depend on its root. Even a severed tree will survive if the root is intact, whereas a fully grown tree, once detached from its root, will die. If you train in the way with a thorough comprehension of what your mind really is, then you will conserve your efforts as you easily succeed in realizing Buddhahood. But if you try to train without thoroughly comprehending what your mind really is, then you will squander your efforts to no avail. This is why you should be aware all good and evil proceed from your own mind, so that should your mind try to seek for something outside and separate from yourself, you will miss the point. So it's actually important to understand really what he's talking about in meditation. The essence of meditation isn't really the formal thing of looking at the wall, putting your hands in the mudra, you know, staring at the wall. The essence of the meditation is that you're being still and present, not grasping after anything, not pushing anything away. You're basically being still, you know. And when you sit down to meditate, what arises is all that's not still, your mind scurrying about, yourself getting caught up in this and that. And actually, the world, another way of translating the meditation was just beholding the mind. That's the way Red Pine translated it. But he really meant meditation is beholding the mind, because that's what you're seeing. And actually, the whole world, the universe, is all your mind, because that's the only universe you know. Everything is in your mind. You know, you think that there's this or that, but it's all in your mind. Good, bad, right, wrong, you know, all the old movies you've seen, you know, everything is in your mind. Your likes, your dislikes, the way you perceive things. And thus, if you convert the world in your mind, then the whole world becomes the Buddha world. You know, if you don't convert your old mind, it all becomes, you know, anger, it becomes frustration, it becomes worry. In training, at times, if I'm seemingly doing, you know, kind of not doing badly, I can look around and see everything. Can see that there's a good heart all around me. Could see something positive. Could feel gratitude for so much I'm being given. If I'm having a hard time, sometimes I'm looking and all I'm seeing is everyone's faults. How everything is in my way and the whole world becomes an obstacle. You know, it's like you can go through the day having obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. You know, it's the way some people can wake up in the morning and just get angry about everything. I know I've met people who actually read the newspaper every day and get upset every single day. It's like they'll read the newspaper and just rail against the world. So the whole world is the way we relate to it. And what we're trying to do is see the world through the mind of meditation, which is seeing it without demanding, asking, without pushing away any aspect of reality or the way the world presents itself, or grasping after any aspect of reality or how it appears to us. And actually, with the mind of meditation, it doesn't really matter greatly if what we're perceiving is actually reality or not. For instance, I remember kind of being told, you know, like when you counsel somebody, you know, they were kind of explaining how they couldn't tell if what somebody experienced was true or false or what was going on. And what their instructions were, it actually doesn't make any difference. All that matters is how they relate to it. You know, it's like if you see a Buddha and you're making it up in your mind, but you relate to it properly, it's good. It's a Buddha. If you're grasping after it or pushing it away, it's a problem. Even if it's true, it'll be a problem. Just like you can misperceive what somebody's doing, but if you relate to it without grasping or pushing away and just do what's good to do, you'll learn eventually. And it doesn't really matter if it was a misperception or perception. But the reality doesn't matter. It's how we relate to it that matters. And, you know, and meditation is the course, because meditation is us just being there, being willing to be still and present with an open heart, accepting what's unfolding, whatever's flowing through us, and not getting caught up in whatever it is that's flowing through us, whatever karmic conditions, whatever the perceptions are, whatever the health sickness, likes, dislikes, good feelings, bad feelings. It's like if you look at the basic instruction, whatever you're doing, you're trying not to be moved to it. The wisdom in Buddhism comes from not reacting to the karma, not getting caught up in the karma, you know. And, you know, and it's just like there's a thing where the Buddha kind of taught that the knower of the world, and he wasn't actually talking about knowing science, knowing the actual world. He was talking more about knowing the world as it appears in our hearts and mind, the wheel of samsara that rolls in us. Because that's the world, the way we grasp after birth and death. And in meditation, we're trying to, by sitting still, kind of experience the impermanence and the kind of empty nature of everything when we don't make something out of it. You know, it's transitory nature. It's Nagarjuna's line, he who sees the impermanence and the changeable nature of everything will see the Buddha. And in a way, one way of looking at it is nothing really special ever happens. That's why in Buddhism they'll say if you're meditating and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas appear, bow and don't treat it special. Demons and devils appear, bow and don't treat it special. You know, People are often spending their lives trying to find something special, something to exhilarate, something to make them feel important, significant. Well, it's really nice to know that the real treasure is found by just opening your heart to the mundane things in daily life. You know, as the old saying, the most excellent mirror, samadhi, see the wooden figure sings. You know, that if you're really still, everything can sing. The light of Buddha can be in everything. Meditation is, again, what it's doing, it's a wholeness. It's embracing whatever is there. While actually samsara, our desires, fragment everything into what we want and what we don't want. You know, I like this and I don't like that. As trust in the heart, you know, the Kanchi Sōsan wrote a few generations later, the way is easy for those who do not pick and choose. We fragment reality, good and bad, right and wrong, what we want, what we don't want. And, well, when we sit still, there's a wholeness that, in a way, our mind can't comprehend. Of course, our mind can't kind of grasp it, but it's there and we feel it in our heart, because it's not like our mind can embrace, you know, have a picture of it, but it's a wholeness that's there, and that we experience it as the connection, the deep meaningfulness of all those things. The same way as on a retreat, it's usually an experience most people will have is by applying mindfulness and the attention that you're usually applying to things that you don't generally do. Most of the time, one of the advantages of a retreat schedule is that you're often much more just rushing through life, getting caught up in where you're going, what you're doing. And it's much, you know, while here you'll be sweeping a floor, washing a dish, and there can be at times a real specialness to it. I remember a story one of the monks used to like telling, where she kind of arrived in the monastery, was a kind of the most junior monk in the monastery, and suddenly there was a tea, and she didn't get invited to the tea. I remember hearing the story. I realized people just forgot to tell her to go, but that's still the story. So she was in the kitchen washing dishes, feeling very sorry for herself. Woe is me. Everyone's having tea, a good time, and here I am washing dishes. And we used to use these, some of the old timers will all remember it, these hard plastic cups, kind of melamine, that would actually have these coffee stains in it, you know, that kind of get absorbed and they get really discolored. So she said she picked up one of these cups and looked at it and said, oh, let me give it a good cleaning. Put in some cleanser and started to really clean the cup. And suddenly she said the whole cup lit up. And, you know, and suddenly it just something really illuminated. And she said she actually got a little scared, put the cup down. But what was happening was, despite the despair and that feeling of being, she let it go and wholeheartedly treated something like the Buddha, you know, something special. Just one of these cups that actually, you know, was so unspecial. I remember going to a secondhand store in Dunsmuir, and they had a large bag of these cups. And when I said, how much are they? They said, take them. you know, but in a way, we do that through our training. It's how we approach things, because they were actually just not particularly good cups. I mean, I can even remember replacing them as guest master, thinking we can have better cups than these. But on the other hand, everything, they're as special as anything else, you know, no different than a giant duel, a painting of Rembrandt, you know, the most gorgeous thing. You know, if you look with the eyes of a Buddha, you will see the heart of a Buddha. And And Buddhism, our very being here, arises out of your longing for something much deeper, something boundless, something that isn't being almost trapped by this wheel of birth and death. And you have to, what Bodhidharma is talking about is meditation is the essence of it. It's that mind that can let things go. Let whatever arises, arise. Let it pass. And trust that the real heart, you know, the real cup is always there. The real light will be there. It's just how we relate to it. And here's a nice quote I always like from Shantideva, where he goes, "All anxiety and fear, immeasurable pain and suffering, the source and wellspring is our own mind itself, thus the Buddha said." You know, and that actually is a real help when we can actually start recognizing that the world's, the nice thing about it is, most of us think in order to be happy, we have to change the world, which is going to be really hard. While from a Buddhist point of view, is all you have to do is convert your heart, and the whole world can be like that cup, can be like that person you hate, who you can see just like the cup. And what Bodhidharma is really talking about is that seeing the world with this stillness and acceptance that doesn't make a problem out of it, and then its real light can be seen. And we have to really look at what we're asking for, because often we're asking for things and then, you know, getting upset with what unfolds. You know, it's like the famous, St. John of the Cross's famous line, "Want nothing, have nothing, know nothing." If you want something, you're going to be disappointed when you don't get it. If you think you know anything, it's kind of useful. You only know so little, you know. And you really can never possess anything, really. It's all flowing through you, and even if you try to grasp it, it'll be gone. And the non-meditative mind believes the reality and urgency of our opinions and desires then, and kind of molds them into this view of reality, which is just our opinions, desires, making the world. Because that's what gives the world meaning. You know, people should be doing this, not doing that. People, you know, everything should be the way that it is. It's like, I always kind of smile at people who have, like, there's the natural world and there's nature and then there's humans. And I think, actually, you know, we are the natural world. You know, we're animals, we're mammals, we're not different. The fact that, it's like my cat cries for food, it's an animal, somebody else wants this, they're an animal. Being human, we can see our choices better than animals, and that's the advantage of the teaching. But on the other hand, when I seem to do a lot of animal ceremonies at Berkeley. I think I lead the order for a temple in doing animal ceremonies. And in the line it begins with, "From the beginning, there's neither birth nor death. Because of the accumulation of karma, you receive the body of an animal. Discard this karmic body quickly and enter the world of purity." And I think, Kinrei, that's what I'm, discard this. I have a body of an animal. Discard this karmic body quickly and enter the world of purity. You know, or when the monks shave. "Now as we are being shaved, let us pray that we may leave behind worldly desires for eternity. After all, neither birth nor death exist." You know, and if the world dissolves, the birth and death dissolves. you know, because you're not clinging to anything. And you know, and it's actually, again, like Nagarjuna said, the ephemeral nature of what flows through our life actually points us to what isn't changing, to what isn't real, the real nature of, you know, just like the ephemeral nature of ourself in Buddhism reveals the true self, the boundless heart of Buddha that's there. And, you know, when we, and then the beholding the mind, we use the arising of the karma as incentives, the fire of suffering as incentives to realize unless we look deeper, what's going on is going to bound us. You know, and the nice thing about training, one moment doesn't stand against the next moment. So if you make a mistake one moment, you know, do something wrong, fall down, it doesn't stand against that the whole way opens the next moment. In fact, one of Bodhidharma's expressions that's attributed to him is seven times down, seven times up. That each time you fall down and get up. And I remember as a young monk going up at one of those ceremonies we do where we ask questions of a monk. And I went up and said, I keep making a mess of things. And the monk said, training is falling down and getting up. Falling down and getting up. There's never a problem in falling down as long as one is willing to get up. Instead of just lying there complaining or despairing. Like I can't do this. Instead, just get up. And, you know, and that's the... kind of the essence of it. And let me just go to the next line of this, which is Bodhidharma replied, when the Bodhisattvas and Mahasattvas put into practice the profound Prajnaparamita, which is really the teaching of the scripture of great wisdom, which is the Heart Sutra, the heart of the Prajnaparamita teachings. Then since we know the four elements, earth, water, wind, and fire, and the five skandhas, are empty of any substantiality and without any permanent self, they clearly seem that their own minds have two distinct conditions. What are these two? The first, the mind immaculate. The second, the mind stained. The mind immaculate is, of course, the true real mind, which is beyond defilements. The mind stained is none other than the mind operating from ignorance, defiled by its passions and cravings. And again, by realizing everything is in its own mind, all of training is really can be seen as dealing with those defilements, with the greed, the passion. Or greed, hate, and delusion. Actually, I usually often like viewing it instead of just as greed, but as desire. It covers more. You know, it covers anything you want other than what you're being given. And hate or anger really covers all ill will, whether it's envy, jealousy, hate, fear too, in a way. And then there's delusion or ignorance. And it's very important, helpful to understand that all ill will is just coming out of desire. It's just the opposite of desire. You know, you're not getting what you want. So you're envious, jealous, despairing, fearful. Whatever it is, it just means you're basically not getting what you want. And then the ignorance and the delusion are the ways we explain why it's okay to hate and desire. And you can find, and we all do that. I mean, think of how righteous anger, righteous indignation, you can feel how right it is to do that. And I'll probably talk, you know, mostly tomorrow about the defilements, but again, beholding everything in your own mind is realizing the problem is never lies in what you're angry about. The problem lies in the anger. Never lies in what the desire's for. It's the problem is the desire. The problem's the fear. And that's always where the problem is. And then you behold it in your mind and you realize that's where the difficulty lies. The fact that you have this envy, and stop looking at what it's about and just try to see, okay, how do I deal with this, with this envy? And, and one of the original translations of defilements is torments of the mind. And it's actually what all our suffering is. It's the defilements. And they become real only because we identify and hold on to them. And they arise due to our conditioning, due to karma. The children have them. They're full of desire. They get upset. They get, we don't even think it's, like, wow, a small child should be beyond. you shouldn't be bothered by that. But training is actually learning to convert the defilements so we don't feel bound by them. Instead of seeing the world in terms of the defilements, we can convert the desires into compassion, the passionate rejection of things into love or loving kindness. Often works for me better than just love. And then the delusion and ignorance into wisdom that can see beyond self and others, that can see the body of the Buddha wherever you look. Or as our Master Ji used to like using, if you look with the eyes of a Buddha, you will see the heart of a Buddha. So, we're trying to look always with the eyes of a Buddha. And, and it's very helpful to see that the defilements just come from us. The unenlightened kind of view, and it's one of those points that it's very hard to realize they're all in our own hearts, not in the external circumstances. I remember talking to somebody who'd been practicing a long time, but, I was explaining to this, and he said, but gave me an example. I was talking to somebody, and they just wouldn't stop talking. It's so annoying. And I said, well, why is somebody talking annoying? It's like for them it was inherently annoying rather than realizing just somebody talking. It's like there's nothing annoying. It's like being, an image of like using the Bay Area. It's like being stuck in traffic. You're in a perfectly comfortable car, in a comfortable seat, not going anywhere. Why is that a problem? but of course, the only reason it's a problem is you're thinking, I want to be there rather than here. And that's it. And often when I get there, I don't even have anything I particularly want to do. You know what I mean? It's like, if you know what I'm saying, it's not like I have to do something when I get there. Sometimes I'm just going home, and it's like when I get there, I'm not doing, I don't have anything on my agenda. Sometimes I'm going to, but it's like, I don't want to be here. And so much of life is like that. So we have to really see that the arising of aversion is not the problem. The arising of fear is not the problem. The arising of greed is not the problem. The problem is we don't know how, that it's really not us. It's just something passing through us. And so we can just see it as the arising of something instead of taking it to heart. I am the anger. I am the desire. I am the feeling. And that which sees something as just not us isn't being bound by it. You know, and that allows us to have wisdom. When you see it as part of you, you're actually seeing it through ignorance and then feeling bound by it. And that's an important aspect of training. Just see it as something. It's your rising and passing of something. You know, it's and something, you know, just to train with. Anyway, I'll try to, you know, actually, as I kind of smilingly told somebody, I love talking about defilements, you know. I feel like it's something I know so intimately. You know, so I'll probably do the last talk and cover some of the rest of this, that where Bodhidharma talks a lot more about, you know, dealing with greed, hate, and delusion, and the conversion of it and not seeing it as real. And that'll probably be, I feel like I haven't covered that much of Bodhidharma's text, but that's to me a lot of the essence of what he's teaching. And some, you know, and even though, you know, and just to explain those points are kind of, you know, take a lot. So, homage to all the Buddhas in the world. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all the worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.